Welcome to Writers Talking TV, brought to you by the Writers Guild of Canada. I'm Dennis McGrath. Today's interview deals with a fascinating arena for writing and a new one, web series. No one can be sure what television will look like 10 years from now, but one thing's for certain, it will involve the internet. Today's guest is a longtime Canadian television writer and one of the pioneers in this area in this country, Jill Golic. She's also the president of the Writers Guild of Canada. And today, she'll be talking about her new web series, Ruby Sky PI. Just a little warning, tonight's podcast involves people talking from the audience, so there might be a few areas that are a little difficult to understand. We apologize for that. We'll do the best we can to clean them up. All right, so welcome everybody. Here we are at Camera Lounge in Toronto. It's nice to welcome back to the series executive producer and creator of Ruby Sky PI, Jill Golic. We're also joined by Julia Cohen, who's her writing partner and also big on this enterprise. Later on, we'll be screening some episodes of Ruby Sky PI, including one that has been recently nominated for a WGC Screenwriting Award, so congratulations for that.
Thank you. Also, we
have some special guests in the house, I hear. We have people who are very much more familiar with this type of writing than I am, so we'll do a little bit of questioning later, and then maybe I'm hoping that we can open it up and actually maybe share a little bit of other people's experiences of working in this medium, because God knows I'd like to hear more than the same presentation I seem to have seen 15 times at all these different internet conferences.
I hope you're not referring to me.
I'm not referring to you. You're always scintillating. But just to set the tone, here's what up to the minute we're talking about. Obviously, nobody has sort of figured out the way to make great big money doing web series or things on the internet anymore yet. So it's the big sort of thing that, you know, that seems to be the question that drives everything. But culturally, there's no denying where we are in this moment. And if you want an up-to-the-date reference, this will be dated for the podcast, but it's current today. At 5 p.m. today, apparently, Charlie Sheen joined Twitter. And the last time I checked, at 7:10, he had 158,000 followers. He got 158,000 followers in 2 hours and 10 minutes. And he's tweeted exactly once.
And was it obscene?
No, but it was. It did have a picture. So, you know, there's no question that obviously in terms of if we're all being responsible storytellers, the time where we could sort of has come where we have to reconfigure and reconceive a little bit about what we do and bring it into this new medium. So I guess maybe the first question to open up with is to talk about the genesis of Ruby Sky. And was this a project that you started thinking about as a web series, or was it a television series that you adapted for the web, or how did it come about, and how did you go about those first steps of taking it from the bare idea to the
This is where you tell the truth.
Okay,
so the original idea was we were pitching a movie idea for, what's the name of it? Harry. Can I say the name?
No. Okay. Harry the Spy.
Okay. They were looking for someone to write this, a backdoor pilot movie thing. And so our agent got us in the door, and Jill came up with an idea, and we came up with another idea, and we pitched it, and we were brilliant. They didn't want to hear from us, but we were brilliant.
Mm-hmm.
And we were. We were brilliant. And they said, they love us, we want more. So we worked another 2 hours and came up with, like, more brilliant stuff, and they loved us.
And they laughed on the phone, and it was fantastic.
And then it was between us and someone else, and they took the someone else. But Jill was like a little pit bull with this idea, and she loved it so much, and so she called me and she said, I'm turning it into something totally different. We're using the same idea, but
the same basic story,
but different characters. And she says, we're doing it for the internet. And then I went, okay, because I know nothing about the internet. And so she just took it and then
But in terms of turning it into a web series, what we did was, I mean, we knew we wanted 12 episodes, so we had already broken an MOW with six act breaks. So we just had to slice them all in half and you know, and then sort of heat up our curtains a little bit more so that we would have really great cliffhanger endings. Mm-hmm. But that's the genesis.
See, it's interesting because to me, there's what I discovered. I just got back. I was working for a while in California recently. And I ran into, while I was there, a woman I knew from Toronto has hooked up with this whole internet kind of posse. Mm-hmm. And she actually is in what I would call almost a different evolutionary strain of creating stuff for the web. Whereas you come out of the television background and the traditional movie background. And then there are these people that you tend to see at more of the conferences who are the people that, you know, weren't established and come up through that YouTube thing, and it's very personality driven, and it's a very different. So they do their little videos, and then the answer videos, and the they do videos asking for reactions, and then comment on the audience's. And it's very much about a personal relationship with the people following them on their YouTube channels, and.
That's a little bit more like reality than like drama. I mean, most of the web series, you know, the people who are working on the web in this room are doing kind of much more dramatic web series where we have a story to tell, but we do have a relationship with our audiences. We know them by name. We, you know, interact with them. Some of them send us money. Some of them don't. But, it is a much different relationship we have with our audiences than we have in television. Because when you rap on a show, the people who you've interacted with while you're writing your show and have been, you know, your broadcaster and your producer and the people in the story room, and by the time it goes to the air and gets seen by the audience, you're on some other project, right? Whereas, you know, when we put our shows on the air, on the web, our audience talks back to us. They leave comments. They like us on Facebook, and we have a completely different relationship with them.
How does that change how you conceive it? Does it change anything about the process of creating the story and how you conceive the story and how it would unfold?
It will, moving forward, very much so. I'm looking at next season now and thinking about making it much more interactive, making it much more open. With what we did and the way we financed it, it was a closed story, but we created opportunities on our website for our audience to participate and be part of, you know, a community. And we'll do that much more so with the storytelling next time around.
It strikes me that, that some of this is the personality driven stuff on the YouTube stuff is very much kind of not what we do.
Mm-mm.
You know, like this is how it is the same as television and how it is the same as storytelling is interesting. There's a quote which I shouldn't say because it's at the end of the podcast, but I saw Joss Whedon. Joss Whedon has been very vocal about the great thing about doing things on the web has been that it can be tiny and perfect and you can do exactly what you want to do. Can you talk a little bit about that aspect of it and the aspect of the creative control that you had and what that was like for you?
Starting with the fact that there's nothing I'd rather do than sit in a room and write with Julie.
Mm-hmm.
We have a lot of fun, and we make each other laugh. And those are the scripts that are on the screen. When you look at it, those are our drafts, the drafts that please us the most.
Except for that line that was taken out, that one line.
Sorry, if you're too wow.
Is that a cutting room line?
One line. Good job.
Any television writer out there in listener land now is listening. You're holding on to one line that
one
got
line.
Taken out.
Well,
that's very different
I'm
than television.
I'm not sure which one. But that would be my fault because I was, you know, I was on set every day, and if we, you know, I mean, nothing ever got changed without my approval. Julie and I tend to write these big mouthfuls of monologues for our characters. We like them to say really long and convoluted sentences, and we were really lucky that we were able to find a kid to cast as Ruby who was able to manage that dialogue just perfectly. But, you know, again, that was my casting, you know. I cast the show.
She did everything.
I picked the, you know, I found a director who I love and who was able to do it exactly the way I wanted. And the night before we went into, our first day of PP, you know what that's like. You're killing your script right about then when you're in TV, right? You've got the production department is saying they can't shoot it, and there are all kinds of pressure on you that are making you destroy the script. Probably the best draft is Pink, would you say?
Usually the Pink.
Pink.
Yeah.
The Pink is the one. You know, you put it away and you say that's the one I love. That's going to be the sample, and then after that gets worse and worse and worse.
They say that the rule of thumb is that you're doing well if you can shoot the draft one past where it was best.
Yeah. Well, instead, you know, the night before, instead of, you know, taking apart the script for production benefit, as you know, our executive producer is Karen Walton, who's, you know, known for her writing, not for her producing. And she and I sat down, we went through the script line by line and just said, how can we make this better? Where can we, you know, where can we raise up the story a little bit more? What can we do to improve this from a storytelling point of view? I mean, you don't get that in TV. You don't get that in film.
That's interesting because, of course, you know, it strikes me that we all have this fantasy of creative control as writers and how awesome that would be. Is there a downside to it?
Did you sleep for 2 months.
I still don't have any time to sleep. Yeah, there's a downside to it. You know, there's no money. Mm-hmm. And the work never ends. I mean, you know, and now, today, I'm spending more of my time doing things that fall, you know, under the P word, which I don't like to say. But, you know, I mean, I'm raising money. I'm talking to sponsors. I'm distributing it. You know, all those things that, you know, if I didn't have that, I'd be writing.
Is that what the realities of internet writing right now are driving us towards? As writers, do we all have to prepare ourselves, I guess, or accept the fact that we're all going to have to be, you know,
I don't think anybody. Well, I mean, I just think Jill is exceptionally smart, and she knows how to do everything. I just think she's brilliant. So I don't think everybody could do what she did.
But there are a number of people in this room who are doing it, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, we're doing everything ourselves, right? Right.
Some nods.
Where's that?
You can tell.
Yes, right.
That's right. I was going to say some nods, but you should see there's like a row of bloodshot people here.
Yeah, I mean, and it's almost like we've sort of all found each other recently, and we love getting together because nobody speaks our language the way we do, you know. I mean,
well, let's talk on that a little bit then. What's the new language? What's the new things that you have to learn to speak that, you know, Jill Golic the writer didn't know a year and a half ago that now Jill Golic the multimedia and creator has to know how to say?
All right, I guess there's something about how we distribute our, to what sites, which sites, you know, deliver what they offer, what they say they're going to offer, which ones don't. What formats and output formats we use for our video. We just talked about, Jason and I, deinterlacing on Sunday, which our director, Kelly Harms, hasn't learned yet. What else have we talked about? We talk about how to raise money, how to distribute stuff on the web, how to promote, how to, I guess the big things are distribution and advertising revenues, things like
is
that.
There a
sponsorship.
Is there a problem around the fact that, you know, like, I mean, the sort of the whiff of snake oil that's around this right now? Like, I mean, and what I mean by that is that, you know, again, you talk at these, you know, it seems like there's a next media conference every minute and a half. And I'm a little cynical about this because I worked on a show called Media Television in the early 90s as a producer. And the thing that's shocking to me is that I go to these things now and the people up on the podiums are using all the same buzzwords and saying all the same things and spinning all the same tales as they were saying back in 1993 and 94. And it seems like, you know, it's like we're waiting for a train to arrive that never arrives. And what you do and what the people who are producing here do is the very antithesis to that. You actually have to, you know, the rubber has to meet the road. You've actually got to put a product out there. Do you find it hard to do that with this sort of endless sort of expectation and hype and unsureness and about what's out there and what's possible?
I don't know. I mean, I've been goofing around with storytelling on the web since 2007. The first budget I was able to raise to do something real was, I got the green light from the Independent Production Fund in actually June 18th. And I have had nonstop fun since then. It has been the most creatively fulfilling experience of my entire life, and I am now addicted to it. So, you know, and the whole year before, all I did was speak at Next Media for the whole year. Like, I was like, and both spoke at both Next Medias. I gave did 12 speaking engagements the year before. Nobody calls me anymore.
But, welcome to Canada.
That's right. So I got pretty sick of them, though, on that front.
That's very funny to hear. It's an interesting thing to me that when you're going for this audience, it's, the other thing that's sort of interesting about it is that you're sitting there and you're, when you do a television show, you're at least nominally focusing on whoever your audience is in the territory that you're producing. I mean, we all do co-productions. We all do things that have multiple masters, multiple stories. But at some point, you've got to fix that, you know, audience member in your mind and think, all right, well, the person that we're going for is likely going to be Canadian or American. And it's a kid's show, so we're going for tweens. We're going for this, and we're going for that. Meanwhile, you've got this thing where you're coming up with a show and you're releasing it on the web, and it, you know, anybody and any country can access it at the same time. Does that change the way you shape your stories, or do you try to be more universal, or do you get at universality through specificity, or does that enter your thinking at all?
J.M. Barrie, who wrote Peter Pan, was asked, how do you write for children? And his answer was, I don't write for children. I write for myself. Mm-hmm. I write for Julie.
So we just write to make each other laugh.
And that's...
That's great. Okay. Well...
And the fact that people come from Indonesia... But, we know this about writing. The more specific it is, the more... You know, personal it is, the bigger, the more appeal it has. You know, when you try and fool the audience, you know, it doesn't work.
But it strikes me that in the web series that you're doing, that the opportunity to prove that point that never seems to be able to, you know, other countries get to seem to be able to prove it. You know, they in Britain they get to make the full Monty and set it in Sheffield. And, right. you know, and nobody says, oh, God, don't show it Sheffield because maybe it needs to be Pittsburgh, you know?
Well, I mean, this is, you know, if when you see it, it's Little Italy. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's our neighborhood. We wrote it in on our street. And our street, you know, my street and Julie Street, they were there at the scene headings. And then we went and location scouted in them. And then we shot there. And we used our houses,
and we used our kids on our street, yeah. and we used all. It was a real, true labor of love.
Yeah,
really was
such fun. Okay, so we're gonna watch this in a minute, but I guess just before we break and take a look at Ruby Sky, I guess maybe the last question from a Canadian perspective would be. Again, I had a couple of meetings down in LA and talked to people with the last at Banff. You were there last year too, and there were, you know, there's all these American companies that have their little slush funds that they're just like, we're spending money on web series, we don't know what the hell it's going to be, and it's gonna, you know, and as far as they're concerned, that, you know, these huge corporations like Sony and whatever are literally dropping money down a hole. They don't expect anything to come from it.
There are a few of us who'd like those business cards.
Yeah, no kidding. Me too. But and that might have slowed now, but that's certainly the way it was like 16
months
ago. In fact,
the Warner Digital woman who I spoke to at Banff just told me that Warner Digital has decided to get out of web series. So that was really exciting news.
See what one recession will do for you. But what is the current for those who are sort of maybe the aspirational people who are sitting there at home, thinking of trying to get into writing and trying to maybe produce something themselves. You know, what are the funding opportunities or the areas where you can raise money for this in Canada right now?
In Canada, we have one fund. It's called the Independent Production Fund. And oops, the deadline was 5 o'clock today.
Mm-hmm.
So if you didn't get in, you've got a year to wait. Now, we do hear that a couple of the other funds will open up to stuff that's digital only, but only with a broadcast license. So that might be Bell Fund, Rogers might have some money, and Shaw might have some money a little later in the year. But in those cases, because of the nature of those funds, you will have to have a partner, a broadcast partner, even if it's only for the web. Other than that, in terms of financing, it's friends and family, or sponsors if you can get them.
Mm-hmm. And if this is this is sort of getting a little wonky, but with, you know, the changes in the Canadian broadcast landscape of late, the, you know, the Shaw acquisition of Global, and especially CTV and Bell, especially CTV seems to be going towards this thing where they're gearing themselves more towards content that can be streamable, that can be mobile, and that's a lot of people are speculating that they're going very heavily into sports. Do you see opportunities there for the narrative and for the kind of things that you're doing with web series, or do you think they're not interested?
I don't know, because I don't think everything's really shaken out there yet. I mean, I think eventually we're going to see more and more and more of this. You just can't help it, because you've got new platforms and new technologies, and it's only natural that entertainment is going to migrate there, and that the fact that these platforms and technologies allow the user to interact is going to mean that we're going to see some new interactive forms of storytelling. And then the final thing is, you know, the monolithic broadcasters and big companies only have so much shelf space. But little guys like us can now reach an audience all by ourselves without their help. And that's incredibly appealing. So it's a way for us to offer them a kind of niche product that doesn't exist on the big broadcasters. Like, there are no children's detective series right now. Canada produces sitcom and animation for kids. We couldn't get this on the network because they don't do detective shows for kids.
And there is a huge following. Like, we've seen it. Like, these kids who, like I know, who have seen it are addicted to it. Like,
yeah.
They can't wait for the next one. Like, they'll tell me. Like, some of these kids, like, oh, you know, watch it. Like, you know, and but it spreads. It's like it starts with, you know, my daughter's friends, and it spreads, and they're like all you know, emailing and saying, when's the next Ruby Sky? When is it? Like, what's going to happen? And they can't wait. So it's like
over?
There's an audience. There definitely is an audience.
Okay, that seems like a good place to leave it. Let's talk about reaction a little bit when we come back. But for now, why don't we dim the lights and let's watch the first four episodes of Ruby Sky.
Oh, sure.
But not that short. You. The one we're not, the episode we're nominated for is the next one. Caught Ruby Red Handed. So it's something for you to do when you get home tonight.
I want to see it.
Well, at least it's aspirational.
And the other thing I wanted to mention was the sponsorship model and the way we integrate product into this show. And I want to know if it bugged you, like the Polaroid camera. You know, and the way it was it's an important plot point because without that hard evidence, she can't get caught for shoplifting. So it's a way to show off what the camera does. We never say Polaroid in the show, but that's how we delivered on that
I don't know.
For them.
Anybody bothered by it?
You know, I would have guessed iPhone was your sponsor because that was the word that was said.
Yeah.
If you asked.
Yeah, no, they just let us use their product.
You could see it happening, but it wasn't obtrusive.
Yeah,
show of hands. Anybody sort of bothered by it? I thought it was...
Nothing was obvious.
It actually worked on me, because I thought, oh, that's a neat little...
That's a neat... It's a neat little camera, isn't it? I mean, and everyone on set thought so, too. I mean, we could have sold them right there on the set because it was so cool. And then the other thing, our other product integration sponsor is the Dragon Academy, which is a real private school in downtown Toronto. And so the deal we got made with them was that they gave us the school for a week this summer. And, I mean, Rob was there. We just had, and Alicia, we were there, and we had the run of the place. It was fantastic. To shoot there, and we just, you know, our characters go there and it's their school. And once I went into the school and looked around and saw what the school is like, it just totally informed the characters for us, and it really gave Ruby even more license to be sort of the outsider that she is, and because that's. I mean, not that the school is for outsiders, but it encourages kids to be very creative and be very much themselves.
Great. Okay. Few nitty-gritty. So 12 episodes. What was your budget? What are you saying your budget was?
We put $500,000 on the screen.
Okay.
Including in-kind sponsorships, creative contributions, and cash.
Shooting schedule. How long take you to shoot?
15 days.
15 days.
15 days.
Tell and how much total content?
We've got about an hour of content, 51 minutes.
Did you have? Were there supplemental elements other than the basic narrative itself? Like, did you have like diary or offshoot things or anything like that?
We had a second camera on set almost every day, shooting in the other direction.
Right.
So that we were shooting behind the scenes at all times. We had a professional photographer also on set almost every day, so we have tons and tons of behind the scenes and on, you know, in front of the camera photographs that we can use on our site and on Flickr and YouTube and not YouTube, but Facebook. We also built a flash game that plays rock, paper, scissors. And we shot everyone on the cast and crew throwing rock, paper, scissors. And so you can play against the cast and crew when it automatically does
that. Interesting.
And then there's tons of additional content on site that's kid-facing that, you know, gets into more detail about topics like Nigerian scams, rock, paper, scissors, Brownies. We have every Friday. We have a brownie recipe, because Ruby is a brownie baker, and I bake those brownies.
They're really good.
Okay, crew and kit. How many people did it take to shoot? What was your crew size like? What equipment did you use to shoot it?
We shot on the Canon 5D Mark II, which is a stills camera, not to be confused with the 70, which people don't seem to be happy with. But the 5D was fantastic for us to shoot on. Our crew, Carrie Young, who produced, was also our first AD. We had a director, cinematographer. We had quite a lot. Some days we had quite a lot of people in our camera department. Mm-hmm. Maybe five or six more regulars, and then lots of PAs and
lots of volunteers.
Continuity, craft service. We put our we put all our money on the screen, all of it.
Okay.
And I think it shows.
And putting it together in the end, editing. How long does it take to sort of edit it and get it ready?
We had a difficult rollout schedule because our contract with the Independent Production Fund required us to be online by mid-October and to have at least half our episodes up in the fall, which was so we chose to roll out at two at a time, and that turned out to be a little bit difficult because by that time we were working with a volunteer, our editors deferred. And so we were having a little bit of trouble keeping up with that pace. But then we rented an editing suite for 2 weeks, and that just seemed to just get us right through to
right.
the end. That was one of the things we spent money on and seemed very luxurious and was just fantastic.
Mm-hmm. What it seems to be, there's a little bit of, I wouldn't say controversy, but I've seemed to have read a lot of, there's a lot of difference of opinions on what is the right way to release something like that. What were your deliberations on that fact? Did you find, do you think that now that was the right strategy? Was there any, can you talk a little bit about that sort of element of it?
Well, we released Mondays and Thursdays at noon. Which was very difficult orchestration for me to manage for 6 weeks in a row because, sometimes you'd be in a movie and in a meeting trying to release a video at exactly noon or the internet would go down or it wouldn't, or YouTube wouldn't take the privacy settings off of it at the right moment so that was difficult, but we would always see a spike on our, a huge spike in our traffic right at noon on those days and then throughout that afternoon. And we heard lots of kids, you'd hear kids, parents say, oh, my kid said Mondays and Thursdays. My kid, we got to go watch Ruby Sky. My kid said.
There was one day it was really late.
Yeah.
Right? Everybody was like, where is it?
Where is it? Like, yeah. So creating an event is a good thing. But then, I had this epiphany in the middle of the rollout, and I went, wait, I hate it when television series come out once a week. I like to get them all on DVD and watch them all at once. What am I doing? And so it's that realization that it's there forever. You never stop promoting it. As many people have seen it now, there's still a few people left in the world who haven't seen it, and so we're still, it's always promotion time. It's always promotion.
Yeah, the long tail, right? And it all takes one
one
well-placed blog to discover it like it never had before, and suddenly it's coming. That's interesting. So let's talk now about when it was done and talk a bit about that reaction. So when it first went up and when you finally show it to the world, what was the reaction of the audience? What did you hear from people? What were the comments you heard from various stakeholders?
Well, kids write on our site all the time, I love Ruby, do more, oh my God, this could be a television show. I'll tell you something, kids use a lot of exclamation marks and a lot of I learned to love them. A lot of smiley faces and a lot of exclamation points and not too many capital letters, but we get tons of comments from kids who love it and want to see more.
And more than kids. And parents love it, too. Yeah. Like a lot of the parents are watching it with their kids. Like a lot of kids that I know, their parents are watching it with them, and they're like, they're calling me and going, we love this. Like, when are we going to have more? Yeah.
But that's the amazing thing about a lot of this internet. I mean, maybe it's not amazing. You know, I mean, I think that, you know, I used to come home after school when I was a kid and watch Three's Company. And I think a lot of people had that sort of, it wasn't intended for me, but that's a show I watch. Right. But your relationship really is with them directly. It's completely unmediated, right? Like your audience, you're reaching your audience directly.
But then, you know, I mean, you know, when you look at your stats and you go, look, what's this? Where did all these come from? And then you trace it back. And like, I've found teachers who have blogs where they give assignments to their kids, have set up an assignment that has driven their kids to watch Ruby Sky. So teachers are finding it. I've found it on a teacher's blog with a whole assignment around it. I've found it on a resource page for kids who have gifted. I mean, so there's a whole lot of stuff that's coming down, you know?
What about reaction in the larger community, I guess? Tell me a little bit about what was the... has there been professional reaction to it? Have you heard from...
Is my phone ringing off the hook?
I don't know, not as crassly as that, but I mean, have you heard from some traditional television people? Have you heard from
the
community?
Yes, I mean, people are real... Like, people kind of breathe a sigh of relief, right? Because it looks good, you know? I mean, there's an expectation when you go to look at a web series that it's going to be really productive. Crappy production values, and then people are worried because they're not going to know what to say to you when you say, "Did you watch my show?" And so, but people are very impressed with it in the industry. We're getting a lot of good feedback, and certainly, I think the Independent Production Fund is very happy with what we've done.
Do you feel that you had to the product that's there? Did you have to compromise on it at all, or is that what you set out to do? Is it and how does it maybe compare to some of the work that you have done in traditional television, say?
I don't think we had to compromise at all, except maybe a few actors.
But you always have to do that.
Well, they're actors.
No, it's not the kind of compromise we make when we're writing for hire for on series. You know, it's not like this. This was our vision. This is the show we set out to make. I think it, in many ways, you know, when a team comes together and as it does, and you know, you're collaborating, different people bring things, and you know, what Kelly Harms brought to this in the direction was just way beyond my expectations. It's just, you know, I mean, I would get a little freaked out when I would see the dolly and the Steadicam, but then, you know, it turned out that it was exactly right, and so it's actually, you know, I didn't think we could achieve this. Not, I mean, it's 9 months since we got a green light. We were online, I guess. Wait, June, July, August. We were online within 5 months. Of green light, so I mean that, and we didn't have finished scripts at green light, or we didn't have any scripts. We had two scripts at green light, so I mean, it happened very fast, and that too is incredibly thrilling, right? Mm-hmm. Like you know, you could still be in development now.
Mm-hmm.
So,
but it had and had that feeling of, hey kid, let's put on a show. Yeah. You know, yeah. It was like. It was really a labor of love. It was like everybody was so excited about it, and everybody worked so hard. It wasn't like because nobody was, there wasn't a big budget, and nobody was getting paid.
We had the world's best crew, the best crew on the planet. We called them every single day. Mm-hmm. People came and really worked really, really hard. One of the things we did was we put everybody's Twitter, like we had a space on our crew call sheet for Twitter. Mm-hmm. You know, even there was half a dozen people who were tweeting at the beginning. But by the end, I mean, lots of people were tweeting because they'd see someone else doing it and giggling. And that was another way we built kind of a buzz around the show early on.
That's kind of interesting. Mm-hmm. So have you? What else have you done in terms of using social media to promote it in terms of going, obviously that's, you know, there's no ad budget, there's no, it's word of mouth. So what have you learned about, you're an old hand at this now, Jill, you've been through this a few times, so what have you learned about the effectiveness of promoting your web series as opposed to somebody who goes out there and goes to all this trouble and, you know, sits there lonely at home trying to watch their hit counter tick up and nobody's visiting their site and then they get all sad and droopy-eared.
Keywords are incredibly important in on your videos to make them do good work on YouTube. Our audience is not on Twitter.
Mm-hmm.
So Facebook is our number one driver. I don't know, is Facebook your number one driver?
I'm not sure. We have more followers on our Facebook page, but mm-hmm. more interactions via Twitter, even though it's like half.
But what about coming to your site? Like driving into your site.
These days, most of it is references. That's because of the keywords.
Yeah.
And still from other popular culture sites like OneMoreLesbian.com and After Ellen. Those are still big for us.
That's Jason. His show is called Out With Dad. And Ash, what about you? Is it coming from Facebook? Where's your...
A lot of Twitter.
A lot of Twitter.
Facebook. And we're on YouTube, but in our analytics, we have like that sort of mystery category of mobile content.
Oh,
which
yes.
doesn't really tell
Likewise.
Us. We've been getting tons and tons of hits from there.
Yeah,
no
it's
idea.
Like almost 15-20%.
Explain this to me. That's microwave porn at the back, by the way.
There's an insight page on YouTube that shows you your daily hits, and then it breaks down your demographics and whatnot. So when you go through into discovery, it'll say, like, you know, you got 500 hits from people searching porn, the word porn on YouTube. And
yeah,
you,
you have that.
It was, like, pretty substantial. Like, there's probably been, like, 35, 40,000 hits we got.
Yeah,
it just says mobile devices, and then if you check the question mark, it just says, but it can't track what that is.
Okay, so it's coming off mobile.
Putting porn.
He's got porn with that. Teenage detective.
like the Boxy Box and those other, like, set-top devices that pull off the YouTube server. I'm not sure about that, but I think that's... And, of course, we have the word porn in the title.
Yeah.
Yes.
That's
the key.
We have teen detective, and you have porn.
It is... It is the thing that drives the internet. My last writer's room, we had a bet about... We tried to come up with the thing that what would it take to get no porn results in the first three pages. And I thought it was quite brilliant. Somebody else came up with Abraham Lincoln and porn. And, no... So, page two, there was some terrible, terrible, nasty stuff. So,
well, before I ask Rob about his Facebook stuff, I just want to mention that there's one site. I said this on Saturday too. There's one site where we uploaded Ruby Sky to it, and they marked it as X-rated. And one of our keywords is tween sisters.
Oh.
And we got just a ton of hits. And then it was so sad when we had to tell them, no, it's a... we got nasty comments, like, what is this? So we had to tell them it was a family
show.
Yeah,
there's not a... I think that's the...
Keep
there's,
watching till the end.
There's not a... That is one area where synergy doesn't work. I don't think there's a lot of tween show porn crossover.
No.
At least there shouldn't be.
No. So just let's go to Rob because his show is Rufus the Dog.
Sure.
And where does your traffic?
I just want, for the case of the podcast, because it might get a little rangy out here, we have some guests in the audience here that are from other web series, Canadian web series, making it work. And the first one, you know, what we're missing is a little bit of context. So if it's Out With Dad, can you describe the 10-second description
sure,
of your...
Sure. Out With Dad is about a teen girl and her single dad, played by Will here.
Right.
And she's going through the process of coming out of the closet. He suspects that she might be gay, doesn't know how to talk to her about it, and that's kind of, without giving too much away, that's kind of what it's about.
Wow, that's awesome. And is that outwithdad.com?
Outwithdad.com.
And obviously, Ruby Sky is rubysky.com.
RubySkyPI.com.
Ruby Sky with an E on the end, so RubySkyePI.com.
And at RubySky.com will take you to a bar in San Francisco, which is also good.
All right. Educational its own way. And at the back, we have Microwave Porn.
Right.
And do you want to give us a little description of that series?
Sure. It's about a guy, Dave Lesterman, and his microwave comes to light. So he has a talking microwave that happens to have a pornography addiction. And the microwave tries to help Dave with his dating problems. And that's comes to
the show. This is fiction? It's more of a bio thing, really. Whatever. It's I Am Number 4. And that's microwaveporn.com?
It's at youtube.com/cancelproof, and then we have cancelproof.com as well.
Cancelproof.com.
That's the name of the company.
Excellent. And now why don't we move on to Rob. You want to tell us about your show?
Yeah, it's Rufus the Dog, rufusthedog.net, also .tv.com. You know,
right.
It takes you there. Rufus actually started out as a television series on YTV about 10 years ago. God. More than 10 years ago, and it only ran for 2 seasons. CRTC changed the rules on what broadcasters had to do for Canadian content, especially for kids, and everything was summarily canceled, even though we were getting good numbers. So that languished for a while. I split from the company that I had founded, Rapid Sheet Productions. We've been producing a lot of children's stuff. I took the show back with me as part of the departure package, and I've been putting all the original episodes up online and gearing up new material that's going to be following that up. So it's starting out as repurposing television material for online exhibition, but then expanding from that into storybooks based on those original things, audiobooks. There's all, every show's got original music as well. And then we just finished, we did a Christmas special that we raised a little bit of money for, our own version of Charles Dickens' Christmas Carol. With this Rufus the Dog character as Scrooge. And we shot very quickly, had 4 days to shoot this thing for a half-hour holiday special. We had hoped to get it out in time for Christmas, and that didn't happen. It's still in post, but it's looking
next Christmas.
Grand. Yeah, yeah, it's great. It's all green screen with puppets and CG backgrounds and stuff.
Wow, terrific.
And, you know, I mean, this, you know, brings us one of the amazing things about the web. I mean, in each of these shows, you can see the same thing. None of them are right for television right
yeah.
now. We don't do puppets anymore. We certainly don't do teenage lesbians. And microwave porn, maybe after midnight. But, you know, this is a way for us to, you know, all, you know, to take our talents and our stories to an audience. And it just goes to show that, you know, there just isn't enough shelf space for the...
There definitely isn't a conglomerate. I mean, I don't know if people in this room... one of the things I got addicted to when I was working the last little while, because, you know, in L.A., the dirty little secret of Los Angeles is nobody goes out if you're over the age of 30, right? So I watch a lot more TV. I got addicted to that Tosh.0 show. Oh. Did anybody watch that show? All the guy does is repurpose internet videos, and it's a hilarious show every week. And it really makes you realize the amount of creativity that is there on the web. I mean, that's that, you know, Out with Dad, that is a fascinating, that's a great concept. And it's, you know, and the best thing about it is that it's the best kind of high concept. It's low concept, high concept. You instantly get what that show is, and you go, well, I've never seen anything even like that. And I want to see something called microwave porn. And Rufus the Dog is, you know, that sounds kind of good too. Does Rufus know Hobo at all?
No, that's just good friends.
Because I am fascinated by the fact that CTV, they won't, you know, nobody will give any numbers or whatever, but CTV still has those crappy old Littlest Hobo episodes online, and I hear from people there that people are watching them. Like
almost
every
on Twitter.
Yeah, every day. Yeah, absolutely. So... So maybe now the question to throw to everybody, and you can all answer in turn, is now that you've experienced this and you've done this and you've moved into this arena, what have you learned? What have you learned about, and what would you do different? What are you going to do differently for season 2 of Ruby Sky moving forward you know, what's going to be easier, and what do you think you're going to do differently?
I'm going to put a much larger budget towards promotion and marketing, and I'm going to have a full-time community manager out there interacting with the audience on Twitter, on Facebook, and on YouTube, so that I don't have to do it myself.
But see, that's fascinating. So you're telling me a Canadian web series, the biggest number one problem you have is exactly this problem that Canadian TV has itself, which is, you know, often a paucity of promotion.
Except in Canadian television, you have no control over whether they market your show.
Yeah.
Whereas I have complete control over it. And if I have the budget to, I mean, you know, I was just listening to Terry O'Reilly's Age of Persuasion on marketing movies, and he says that many films have as much as 50% of their budget spent on marketing. And that, I went, oh, you know, mm-hmm. because I was down at, you know, like 1%.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that, you know, you have to really, I mean, there's a lot of do-it-yourself stuff you can do, but you still need to have someone in that job doing it and respect that marketing is a huge part of getting your show out there to people.
Mm-hmm. Do you want to throw it open? What did you guys find?
I just dived in because I have the story that I wanted to tell, right? And, you know, when I was sort of researching, should I do this? And all I found was crap on the internet about how, you know, how to fix your kid, make him straight.
Oh, perfect. Right? Great. Yeah.
Yeah. And I was just like, okay, so if this is all the information that's out there, I want to provide a positive example of maybe what to do if you're in the situation. So that was sort of, that was the driving force for me. So I just pulled together people I could, did auditions, got a great cast, a really good cast. And I actually knew him beforehand. And then, you know, got to work. Now, when it comes to the marketing aspect, which is, I mean, another way of saying that is audience interaction.
Right.
That part never occurred to me how overwhelmingly difficult that is. Because that's, and I'm doing all of it, right? So in addition to writing it, directing it, being a cinematographer, doing the post-production, including special effects, I also had to learn how to do web page design, Twitter, Facebook, all that kind of stuff. So I'm maintaining all that at the same time. I don't think I've slept since, when did we start filming? April of last year.
Yeah, at least a year.
And just the other day, my wife asked me, so when are we going to have some me time? I said, I think August.
2012.
I thought you were
going to say, So, like Jill, I would say, you know, I'm hoping to find someone that can kind of take over the social networking part of it. As much as I enjoy it, because I actually really do, like, I've made some good friends. Like, just Will and I just today got an email from this girl in Italy that we've sort of befriended. She actually was setting up to get a visa to come over to Canada on a work education visa thing,
yeah.
and she's hoping she'd be able to help us out in season two kind of thing.
Wow.
And it's not happening, unfortunately. There's some visa issue, but...
because she's like, she never knew us until she saw the show.
Yeah.
It was that important to her. She was going to try and get a visa to come over and help us with season two.
Yeah.
Like, that's crazy.
So, and there's a girl in Costa Rica who's also kind of the same thing. She's like, you know,
yeah,
I wonder if I can help you. A lot of these guys are filmmakers, right?
Yeah.
Do you find that, as you know, what's always struck me as interesting is that, you know, you look at, it only happens in very few TV shows. You get, like, the Joss Whedon shows. Get these incredibly passionate fans that, you know, your fans are the people that will just live and die for you. And, you know, and in soaps you've had that. But it strikes me that a lot of the web stuff, there is always that core that are really, really, really committed to you.
And
and that's because you can talk to them. You know,
but you know what? There's more to it than that. And I think that a lot of, like, the shows that we're doing here, it's a niche audience.
Yeah.
And I think that that's the key thing here because, you know, you look at television... You know, if you want to see a show like Friends, there's Friends and then there's 1,000 other copies of it, right?
Mm-hmm.
If you want to watch a show from a dad's perspective of a girl coming out and vice versa,
mm-hmm.
I don't know where else to look.
Yeah.
So, and people that need that, that want to watch that, something that they can relate with, there's nowhere else to look for but on the web. So naturally, they're going to go apeshit over it, you know. And the same thing goes with like with sci-fi. Because I mean, still that's a niche thing. It's bigger, but it's still a niche.
Well,
right?
Most niche programming that's on broadcast television is still niche broadcasting. Even though they're supposedly targeting a very specific audience, they're still trying to cast their net as wide as
yeah.
possible.
Yes,
and
right.
And that affects their content.
Well, I mean, the good example, the best example I can come up with for that off the top of my mind is that, you know, the Sci-Fi Channel. Sci-Fi was not a big enough niche for them. They needed to, you know, they needed to go the SYFY
yeah.
because they decided they needed more women watching because sci-fi wasn't a big enough niche for them to make money. So that shows you what niche on television means. But, you know, what strikes me is interesting hearing you guys talk about things like the importance of marketing and social networking, and also the product placement opportunities. Since I remember doing work when I worked for Media Television, 15 years ago, before rap and hip hop was played all the time. There was a time when it wasn't on the radio, right? And the marketing was very niche, and the way that there were all these companies that sort of set up and got into product placement in rap videos and making sure, and that's where they really, the starting of the hip-hop, of styling everything they wore in photo shoots and stuff. And there were whole agencies in New York and stuff that really became tastemakers because that's how you had to communicate to that audience because you couldn't communicate to them through television and through advertising and through the normal channels because, you know, they were locked out of that sort of thing. It strikes me that maybe we're at this edge of this nascent thing where as much of a niche that there is, there are a lot of, you know, girls coming out. There are a lot of you know, gay people that have to come out. There are a lot of friends of gay people. There are a lot of, you know, parents dealing with that sort of thing. And they can't find that reflected anywhere. So, you know, in terms of being entrepreneurial and going forward, maybe there's an opportunity here for us to make up more of our budgets that way or something.
Well, when you were talking before about the buzz of back in the early 90s and the media television stuff, I was involved in interactive media back in the late 80s, doing things with HyperCard and all these other nonsense back then. And everybody was like, oh, this is the way of the future, interactive storytelling, blah, blah, blah. And it very quickly died down because the larger players came in, looked around, threw a shitload of cash at it,
yep.
and then realized, well, there's nothing here, and they walk away because what they were looking for, and we just mentioned the same thing, Jill, about the Warners walking away from web series. They're not able to turn it into what they're used to controlling
right.
and be able to manage it on that level. And if they can't do that, they don't see a business model there. Whereas what we're doing is we're coming at it from a content end, and the business model erupts from that.
Yes.
You find
yes.
your audience, and then the business model comes after.
Yes.
And that's the hard part in terms of upfront funding, certainly.
But that's how Twitter and Facebook
yeah.
and all those companies and Google have all worked, is that they built an audience and then they figured out how to make money from it.
Microwave porn guys, have you had any different experiences that you, in terms of making your thing and things that surprised you about your audience or things that you would do differently now? Yeah.
We don't all, like, we're splitting this online presence between four people, and it's still not enough.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Trying to attack a new audience, it's hard to find the people that would be interested. I mean, it's much easier to let them come to you, but really, how do you get the name out aside from having porn in the title?
Yeah.
That's pretty good.
Which
That's
is
good.
Brilliant,
yeah.
by the way.
Yeah.
I was going to say that when we started doing it, we were just trying to kind of doing what we wanted to do in terms of the show. So I think we did a terrible job in terms of having any kind of marketing strategy. And we spend so much time sort of focusing on making the show that really it seems that like that's been a bit of a secondary thing. And I think as we move forward, we're realizing that we have to put much more effort onto that. Like we've been finally paying attention to our Twitter and sort of like connecting with the people that are, you know, we've got some emails of people who like your show and actually like sort of building that community side of things. So I don't think we were doing that very well in the beginning. You know, and that's sort of been our big step is realizing that that's a huge part of what we're doing here.
Well, one of the things that was fascinating, I think, at the, maybe it was the Primetime conference last year, we were there that we found that was it the Pure Pwnage guys?
Pure Pwnage guys?
They did their web series, and they were really in touch with their audience. And then they got the TV series, and they had to go off and make the TV series, and they disappeared. And their audience went crazy because they weren't accessible anymore.
Well, I don't think that's exactly what happened. I think their audience felt that they were selling out a little bit.
Yeah, yeah.
And then ultimately what happened was their audience continued to watch the show, but they watched it online, not on television, and that didn't work for Showcase.
Right, right. It's also fraught.
And then, of course, you know, Showcase got a big audience for a different kind of a show, which was Lost Girl, right?
Yeah.
And then they changed their course and they said, oh, we're not for 18-year-old boys anymore. We're for, you know, the audience of Lost Girl now. And so then they started building their schedule around that, which is, again, something that happens on television, is that they're building a schedule and you have to, your thing has to be able to jam into that schedule, whereas in the web, there is no schedule.
Yeah,
you can just be there.
I worked on a show that missed the vampire
wave by
this much, right?
Exactly.
And it was a good little show called Blood Ties, and it was fun.
And I'll tell you something, it would do gangbusters on the web.
However, the problem it was exactly that problem, that in the U.S. it was on Lifetime. It was our highest rated show, but the people that came in, but they weren't their viewers.
Mm-hmm.
Right? The people that came in and watched that show and only that show and didn't stick around for the Woman in Peril movies that were, you know, Lifetime's stock and trade.
So as a creator, the television industry is almost incomprehensible, and it's a big long shot, right? Whether you can create something that will fit into one of their tiny little slots. And as you know, as Canadians, we don't have access to 10 o'clock. If we're going to do a half hour, it has to be at 8 or 8:30. If it's going to be an hour, it's got to be at 9. Like, and we have a very narrow opportunity,
mm-hmm.
and so this is a way, this is another way. And the thing is, I think we're all going to make some money. It won't be the kind of money that television generates. But on the other hand, we don't have the overhead and we don't have the broadcasters and the companies taking that big slice off the top that they take off.
Is the next step, in essence, now that we have this tiny little island, all these little islands of people doing their own shows, as opposed to like a broadcast schedule, is the next step cross-promotion, figuring out a way to take all these different series and tie them together somehow, at least to be able to, you know, to exchange links, to exchange, you know, getting known is the important part of it.
Well,
is it not?
We certainly, I think we all sort of feel like that there's power in hanging out together, sharing information, maybe sharing resources. Certainly, I mean, how Twitter works, right? And if I'm retweeting Jason and Ash is retweeting him and Rob is, then his word spreads that much more. And that's something we can really do easily for each other, and share kind of promotional opportunities whenever we can.
We've just scratched the surface with the abilities of that. Yeah.
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 So
I think there's opportunities for aggregators to, you know, sort of set up a particular channel stream of a variety of shows that fit within a particular format or genre.
Right.
But by and large, I mean, everything is so freaking diverse.
Scott Albert, who does Tights and Fights, the web series, and who's a member of the Writers Guild of Canada and a very good writer, he has a blog called The Watch List, where he reviews a web series, which is a tremendous promotional vehicle. I mean, it's driven a lot of views to our show. And so, I mean, little things we do really mean a lot.
We're going to try to get all these links that we've talked about in this podcast up, at least on Facebook, so you can hopefully follow to all these fine people's different web shows and these resources that we've talked about. But I guess one thing that might interest me, and maybe this is a place to, we can open it up to any other questions there might be, But place where I think it might be interesting to end off, and maybe that has an implication for us as writers. There's always been that stream. There's an element of it that is social, that is, you know, you have to pitch, you have to make yourself known, you're going to sell an item in the room.
Yeah.
But there are always that group of writers that really like being alone in their room with their computers and have their relationship with the blinking cursor and not have to actually do a lot of the other stuff. Are those people doomed?
No.
As long as you hook yourself up to someone like
But you've Jill. Got to find somebody to work with.
No.
Yourself with someone who is taking the lead with that stuff, or this what we're doing is going to start generating a level of revenue or a business model that allows us to bring in more people and say,
wait,
yeah, sit in your room and do that.
Like, you look at Rob's Transmedia model, right, for Rufus. I mean, Rufus is going to get so big that Rob won't be able to keep the green screen in his living room anymore. And he'll need other people to write for him. And he'll need specialists, right? He'll need, you know, people who are just great book writers, right? And people who are just great script writers. And those jobs will still exist. It's just that, you know, we talk about this a lot at Council, for example, about how one of the major problems with the Canadian industry is that we do not have the opportunity to put our visions forward. We know that the best shows, the shows that get the biggest audience, are the ones that are led by a strong vision, and this is an opportunity for us to take our visions out there and create shows that are vision driven rather than schedule or.
Well, amen to that. Being able to be vision driven, and also just how nice it is to actually be in a room with people and actually be talking about making something, you know, rather than being in finance or being in something else. Everybody here makes something. We have a product, and you know, we get our hands dirty. And I think there's something noble and great in that. Do we have any questions from the audience? Why don't we? Yes, back there.
I have a question about casting. Can you talk a bit about how you envisioned Ruth and her name? And was her casting at all shaped by the sudden explosion in Canadian ethnicity on TV, you know, with Ciao Italia and Jeff Lloyd and so on and Little Moss? Can you talk a bit about that?
Do you want to talk about her name? look, you know, my daughter was friends with the Ruby. So that's where the name came from. And our intention really was, when we were casting, to put as many ethnicities on the screen as we could. And we were successful in that. But at the same time, we already had Ruby's little sister, Haley, cast way before we even envisioned Ruby, because we had another web series with her. And so we were looking for someone who would or wouldn't match her, I guess, is the way
and
we went.
And I think she happened to be
fabulous. She happened to be fabulous, and she could act, and she has a great look. Yeah. And that's all. I mean, I loved her photograph when I saw her headshot and her resume. She didn't have a lot of experience. She hadn't been in front of a camera before, but she came into the audition and she was just nailed it.
That surprised me. She seemed very, very poised.
She got better and better. and the thing is that we, you know, we shot for a lot longer than you shoot a kid's show. A kid's half hour. Philip, how long did Winging It? How many days was a Winging It shoot?
3 days.
3 days for a half hour. So we shot 15 days for about an hour's worth of content, and we had a week's rehearsal ahead of that time, because we took a much more a film approach to this than a TV approach to the way we shot it. So, and the other thing about kid shows, you were all on set?
Yes.
Yeah, kids shows don't go on location.
Yeah. Well, that's an interesting thing about it, too, actually, that maybe I didn't actually cotton on to until you just said it right now, is that one of the things that's interesting about this, that sets it apart is that a lot of the time when you watch these web series that are derived from TV shows and they split them up, they're kind of unsatisfying because they're not a big meal in and of themselves. They're just, you know, you're just watching one little part, and it's not great. Whereas because you had dollies and you had steady cams, and there was action, there was movement, there was vibrancy in each one of those parts. So the parts in and of themselves delivered a satisfying sort of viewer experience. That separate and apart from watching them stringing together to get the whole narrative. Mm-hmm. So I think that's an interesting part of it too. Yes, we have a question there.
Can you talk about obviously Fulton Favors? Do you have any single principle ruling on paying people? In other words, did everyone get at least something or promise of something? Or how do you structure that?
Carrie Young says, who was our producer and in charge of the budget, says her theory about low-budget filmmaking is she puts the money where she absolutely needs to spend it, and then after that, everybody gets an equal amount. So, you know, the art department and hair and makeup and, you know, wardrobe, all those departments would get, you know, whatever was left was split up among them. All our key creatives deferred. But cast and crew got paid. But
there were still a lot of volunteers.
And there were a lot of volunteers. And all those kids who you see on the screen, I mean, the ones who were just in the classroom, they're all the, I mean, we called our friends and said, bring us your children, because we wanted to see.
Yeah.
There's an incredible pleasure for us. Like, we look at the park scene and we go, oh, look, there's Ben. There's Gracie.
But then they get to tell their friends who get to watch.
That's right. And so then we have all these additional evangelists for our show.
Yeah. So, until when, I
do think that there is a way to make some money out of this piece of content. I think there are a lot of potential for licensing it to other territories. It could play on airlines, for example. It's shot in such a way that it can play on any screen, whatever size. We are in the process of creating a teaching guide that will make it an immediate literacy unit for grade 6 to 8, so we'll be able to make that available with the DVDs. But, you know, if you know distributor, call me.
There is a larger issue that we haven't yet stumbled over with regards to the financing models that we've been talking about, where we are drawing a lot on favors and goodwill the community around us, and I believe you can only keep going back to that well so often, and eventually, you know, this has to become some kind of revenue-generating model in order to sustain itself. Obviously, I mean, people will continue to do things for a labor of love, but eventually, in order to continue doing what we're doing, or to build upon it, there has to be a revenue stream that we can rely on.
But what's interesting about that is that. At least in Canada, that doesn't put us anywhere different than television or film. You know, I mean, the joke that I always like to tell about, you know, the Canadian producer question is the Canadian producer comes to you and says, listen, we don't really have a lot of money. It's a problem. We've got a low budget, and we're trying to get a lot on the screen. So I'm going to ask you, can you please just, you know,
do a draft.
Cut your rate and just do a draft and a year and a half from now I'll have another project and I'll come back and I'll ask you to do exactly the same thing.
Right.
And there's never any step up. So in a way, we're all down here in the dirt together because film and television and web series is no different in this country. But I think
Toronto seems to be a hotbed. What do we count? 15, 17 series either being produced within our community or already online. We've got a lot of different shows here, and they all kind of have a slightly different niche audience. They all have something really special and different to recommend them. And I think we really, like, we're at a very strange point in time, where we have an opportunity to make a dent in that huge machinery that is making media. Like, this is our chance to get in there, and if we have enough volume, and if we work together, we can build this into an industry, and we can all make a living from it. And you know, after years of not having access to our own, to screens, it's a fantastic opportunity, and we have to keep persevering.
And because this is a Writers Guild of Canada sponsored event,
yes,
I guess we should also plug that, you know, digital programs of this type are covered under the collective agreement, and that the rates and everything is fully negotiable, but
very flexible. But we say, bring us your contract, and we will provide you with insurance and retirement benefits.
Which, believe me, means something.
Yes, it does.
Really, really does mean something. Yeah.
And it's also a great way right now to join the guild as well, if you're just starting out, because I believe right now we have a membership incentive where if you join through a digital contract, there is not a membership initiation fee. That's waived.
Is that true?
That is true, right?
Right. Hello, everybody. My name is Jessica Fry, and I'm actually the person in charge of digital initiatives and information at the Writers Guild of Canada. So my email is j.frey@wgc.ca. I'll say it again because I just saw pens come out.
Do we have any other questions?
Just, you know, when you were making it and now you're cutting it, because you know you shot 50 minutes or something, and then now you're posting it, at what point did you decide, okay, I got to get the word out there, you know?
We started getting the word out from the day we got the green light, which I got the email from the Independent Production Fund that they were financing Ruby Sky. And I was actually having my nails done because my daughter's bat mitzvah was the next day. But I stopped right then and there to tweet about it. And we kept that up. We kept that level up very strongly. We were on Twitter. We were blogging about our process all the way through until the day, so that the industry had access to everything we were doing, all the information, all the stuff backstage, and then the day we launched, which
was on Facebook.
On Facebook
for weeks before, too, right? Talking about it.
You also had a teaser.
We shot a teaser. Before we cast Ruby, we shot a teaser with Haley, but we waited to launch that till we were well into production. We had quite a large following on Twitter, and you know, we were getting a lot of hits to the blog, which was just, you know, I video blogged, which was horrifying for everybody. But I was just, you know, I was like trying to have something out there every single day so that people could participate in the process and see what we were doing. And then the day before we launched the teaser, we showed it to the crew at lunchtime. We took our crew picture that day. We put it up on Facebook, opened up our Facebook group page that day with the picture of the crew. So all the crew came and friended the fan page, and, you know, and linked to it and put the crew photo up there. And then we launched the teaser the next day. And with the teaser, what we did was we gave away 25 previews on Twitter. So we had, we were talking about it on Twitter. There were a lot of us on Twitter. We were talking about it. We gave people previews so that a whole bunch of people had seen it. And so the moment we launched it, we saw these huge spikes we like to release at noon. We released it at noon, and just like our traffic went through the roof as people went to watch it. Right now, we can't match any of these guys, but we've got about 100,000 video views on YouTube right now.
Guys, will you just for Sake, one of the other, what are your guys' numbers like?
We have 8 episodes and a couple other things, and we are actually over 625,000 views.
That's great.
Very proud.
Yeah.
Those are,
yeah.
Those are Charlie Sheen numbers.
And porn, what have you got, porn?
We have 10 episodes, and I think we're around 200,000 hits right now.
That's great. Pretty good, yeah. Good.
We're changing our name to Ruby Sky Porn.
Porn
Eye.
Excellent. Excellent.
We're porn.
Yes, we have a question there.
And yeah, she's a lesbian.
About working with the IPF, what that process was like from when you guys got shortlisted until you, when you got greenlit, in terms of like how much creative involvement they had, and what that sort of looked like.
They let us do what we wanted. I mean, it's been a fantastic partnership with them. First of all, so we got shortlisted, and then that was complicated because the day I got shortlisted, I was a screenwriter, and the next day I was a producer, right? And I had to put together a team and figure out how to budget the whole thing and put together. Our proposal ended up being 65 pages with 2 scripts, a Bible, a full budget, bios, and then, you know, a business plan, marketing plan, web distribution plan. Once they gave us the green light, what triggered the funding was we had to have cast and had full scripts, I think. Is that right?
I think so.
We had to have our main casting in place. But other than that, you know, they've just been extremely supportive. They talk about us, they promote us, and you know, we've tried to invite them to everything and give them every opportunity we can to make them like us, and we certainly have enjoyed tremendously the support that they've given us. I mean, they're the only game in town, really.
The only game in town. Awesome. Any last questions? Yep.
I saw on your website that you had a lot of corporate sponsors.
Yes.
And I was wondering how you initially approached them, or did they come to you? And then what was the arrangements, the kind of type of arrangements you had to use?
Many of the sponsors that you see on our website supported us through production. So PS Production Services provided all our lighting gear for free in return for the, you know, promotional considerations. The Dragon Academy, the school, came in, wanted to be part of the show, a little bit more deeply involved in it. We call them a product integration sponsor. The same with Polaroid. Studio Cats did our sound for us. Post City Sound came online and did our post production, which was our sound and mixes, which was fantastic because you don't want a mystery that doesn't have full sound. It's just so important to what we were doing. So we developed a lot of relationships along the way, and some of them were through personal relationships, and sometimes our production managers would like be calling up a service that we needed and say, "No, we don't pay here. You'll have to provide that for us and send us your logo. We're putting it on our site." But I mean, one thing about having a site is that people are much more willing to give you services, certainly, if you can put their logo on the site. And we
lesson number one, look legit.
Yeah. We started off as masters of the social media. Karen Walton, who's one of the executive producers on the show, runs an online community of writers called Ink Canada, and she's very adept in the social media and has many, many followers. I've been on the social media for a long time and have a lot of followers. We had a full-time community manager during production named Doris Tepley, who was on our Ruby Sky feed. So And then many other people in the production were on Twitter a lot. And so we talked about our sponsors all the time. In our, you know, we retweeted them, we follow Friday'd them. When they put stuff on Facebook, we liked it. We are fans of their pages. We promote them any chance we get because we are so grateful for what they have done to us. And it's a really important way that we can, you know, make it known to them how grateful we are.
I think we have time for one or two more questions, if there's any. Yep.
Just wondering what you think is the effect, if anything, on the actually the subjective quality of web programming, considering that the reason that a show like Ruby Sky or The Dad is propagating is continuous is not because of network, you know, they're getting the right numbers, they're not getting the ratings, it's because you guys actually care. And you're the ones doing everything, so there's that passion that's in it. Is it, I mean, do you find that there's an effect? It's not web programming. I'm not talking about your show. I'll say my show's better than network television, that kind of thing. But
I think passion is a tremendous, tremendously important to what we do. It's tremendously important to why we get up in the morning. Dennis, have you felt a lot of passion in story rooms lately?
Waxes and wanes. It's, yeah, I mean, you know, it's difficult. It's you know what I think? I think execution is a more inclusive word than passion. It is about the execution. I mean, you back to...
Not for us. For us, it's about passion. Oh, is it about passion for you? It's about passion for you? It's about passion for you guys?
When I'm not working on it, like if I'm, say, watching The Good Wife or something... That's very good on TV, or something, you know, like if I'm just sort of bumping around the house, I feel guilty that I'm not contributing that time to with that.
Well, there you are.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, oh, I should be checking Twitter. I should be writing something. You know?
But see, my feeling to that would be that is one. That's one bulwark of what the other thing is, which is the, you know, the competence and the level of, you know, professionalism. Maybe is the word that needs to be brought to it, right? Professional rather than. You know, it's not necessarily high production values like Ruby Sky, but there's got to be something in there that's compelling. There's, you know, there's a graveyard of a million unwatched YouTube videos, and there'll be a million unwatched web series as well.
Come on, 90% of everything is bullshit.
90% of everything is bullshit. You know.
Effort into the creation of something that's a scripted series that's not just the YouTube material. You're bringing your passion to it. You're getting everybody else excited about it to make the thing. At some point, if it really sucks, you have to acknowledge that and go, well, I better stop this and do something else. And if you continue just because you're passionate about it, then, you know, you're self-deluding, but you're having fun, and eventually you'll lose your friends, and you'll end up, you know, sitting in a room alone looking at the cursor.
Oh, wait, isn't that my life? No.
you apply your passion to try to make it as best as you can. If it's working, for you, whether it's a subjective opinion or not, if you believe it's working, you carry on.
Yeah.
But by the same token, too, if you go back, I mean, really, it is about the amazing thing about it is the number one misunderstanding that professional writers get, that, you know, that I get asked about, that cab drivers will tell you about. Everybody's always afraid of stealing, of having their idea stolen. Right?
Nah.
Right? And that's the biggest thing. And if you work in this business for a while, you realize after a while, it's just like, the idea is not the thing. Ideas are a dime a dozen. It is the ability to deliver on and to execute that idea that
right.
is important.
If you which look is back, why I hate the button you made, which says, lay the best idea win, which I know has context around it, but I've always said, it's not the best idea that wins, it's the best execution that wins.
Yes, but that's the best idea wins, meaning in the story room. Boy, we're really going to... We're going to air the laundry now?
I'll never get over that button.
I don't like what mom and dad.
She wants approval.
Okay,
Jill wants approval over my buttons. And I think that's a bizarre way to... But you know what? Really, you go back pre-internet. I remember being in the days before the internet when... The only way you could see cool, weird, evil shit was for editors to call you into edit suites. I remember seeing that verse. Come here, see this Christmas card. And you see this, the most cheaply animated piece of shit, like animation, of these four foul-mouthed little boys and a fight between Santa and Jesus. And it was cheap and dumb and stupid, but oh my God, there was something there. And I think that you see that. I think that you see people's reaction to that when they're watching something, no matter what the size of the screen is. The size of the screen doesn't matter. What you do within the frame is the thing that's important. Right? And I think that's the message that we have to get out to everybody as we take these things forward. It's not the idea, it's your ability to deliver on it that matters. Any last question?
No, I have one quick question.
Sure.
You got a $500,000 for your series. Anybody willing to reveal?
I'll reveal. We had $0.
No, but how much did you put on the screen? I didn't get $500,000 cash.
I do not have that math. We didn't do any bookkeeping at all. That was my job. I was busy tweeting.
That would be the thing to fix going forward.
No, but I mean, it was entirely volunteer cast and crew, and I made the joke the other day, like, but it wasn't a joke. 90% of the budget was the catering, which is the labor cost.
Right? Yeah,
and we were joking. Just now, you were saying, but everything that's left over, it gets shared amongst everyone else.
Yeah.
In this case, it was the lasagna. It was leftover lasagna. And that's because he's the lead, no.
Yeah.
We had no, but I did the Kevin Smith style where I used my credit card and maybe one day I'll pay it off. I don't know. I'll tell you when we're not recording. You may ask.
Absolutely. Porn, do you guys have any money?
Yeah, just about $45 an episode. I'll pay for real money, which is just, and sometimes we'll buy props, like we just bought a Yankee costume.
We're going to watch this.
But for our in-kind is pretty substantial because, we all, I work for a production company that lets me use cameras and lights, and we do our audio mix with Jeff Raffin, who lets us use his suite, and I mean, he's an Emmy Award-winning sound editor, so, those services would be worth a small fortune, right?
Sure.
So, there is a lot of value going onto the screen, but in terms of cash, we don't spend very much.
Before we do get into our second season, which we're hoping to get shooting really soon, I do want to sit down and really try and figure out actually what we ought to have spent if we were spending, because I haven't the faintest.
And with tax credits?
Tax credits will apply going forward. We've just had a new ruling last week saying that...
I have a concern about the tax credits only because the process of acquiring them sometimes far outweighs what benefit a really small production would ever get from them. Your production has to be of a certain size to warrant even making the effort to try to get them. So it's great that they're doing that. But I don't think it scales at the moment.
Well, except that that's all our, that's what we spend our money on is labor.
Yeah, but the actual application process.
But they've just reversed the ruling. So for 2011, in theory, we will be able to get tax credits. Yeah.
So all of this is still in flux. So I guess the message is stay tuned and get writing and keep working on it. So anyway, we'll bring this to a close and... thank very much, Jill, and all our guests.
Thank you, guys.
Thanks for listening. Here are some of the sites discussed in tonight's podcast. For Ruby Sky, go to rubyskypi.com. That's RubyskyePi.com. For Rufus the Dog, go to rufusthedog.net. That's RUFFUS.net. For Out With Dad, go to outwithdad.com. And for microwave porn, go to cancelproof.com. If you want information on doing digital web series under a WGC contract, the person to contact is Jessica Fry. Her email is j.fry, F-R-E-Y, @wgc.ca. We'd love to hear from you, so you can email us at writerstalkingtv@gmail.com. If you've enjoyed this podcast, please log on to iTunes and leave us positive feedback. That helps increase the profile of the show.
This podcast is sponsored by the Writers Guild of Canada. The show's technical producer is Philip Vukovich. I'm Dennis McGrath, reminding you that as Joss Whedon once said, movies are big and intense, TV is long and deep, internet is tiny and personal, and mine all mine, but all are worth pursuing. Thanks for listening.